This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 137 was recorded on October 18th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Austrian economist Professor Steve Hanke from Johns Hopkins University joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll talk about money supply, how we got here, and why Professor Hanke sees quantitative tightening as a major risk factor for equity markets. Finally, we'll discuss the theory of hyperinflation and where it is and is not a realistic risk. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview because we've got a really great post-game segment planned for you. Patrick and I will discuss where the critical levels are in the stock market and why those levels are critical. We'll also discuss the dollar, gold, and a whole lot more. And just a quick housekeeping note, folks, we'll be releasing Macro Voices a day early on Wednesday evening next week in order to accommodate Patrick traveling to San Francisco to speak at the Silver and Gold Summit next weekend.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 obviously has bounced considerably off of the sell-off we had last week. But today, here we go back down again, testing down that 2760 level. I have some ideas I want to share in the chart book at the end, but what's your take on where the S&P is?
Well, Patrick, one thing's for sure. This ain't no V-shaped recovery back to new all-time highs. I had been targeting 2837 as a short entry. I thought if we saw the bounce that high, it would be worth taking a chance on the short because I don't see a return to all-time highs. At this point, I'm strongly leaning toward the scenario that the top is in for the year, if not for the entire bull market. What happens exactly next? Well, why don't we save that for post-game? We've got some charts, and I think we need to get into an extended conversation about what could be next for the market.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar index. Now, what was really amazing was this really strong breakout that we had here, but it's more important to me where it came from. You know, we really just simply fib retraced the entire breakout attempt. It wasn't actually any real technical damage to the dollar, and it really feels at this moment like the dollar wants to give this a shot to break out. What's your thinking here? Is this for real?
I think it's for real. Clearly, we're not quite there yet because even with today's breakout, we didn't really see a new high above, what was it, a week ago or 10 days ago, whenever we had the last high. Let me just get it on my chart here. Was on the 9th of October. We haven't broken that high. The next one after that is going to be the high going all the way back to the end of August. I think it was August 15th, actually, middle of August, that we had that big high just as we were in Toronto for Macro Voices Live. Those are the levels to watch, but my gut is that after a fashion, we're going to get through both of them and move higher on the dollar. I don't think it's quite time to say that it's guaranteed yet. We got a couple of key levels to move above, but I think that we're definitely headed higher.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because technically I was watching the kind of round numbers, the 70 level on the WTI, the 80 level on Brent. My first intuition was I thought the bulls were going to at least give it a shot to defend that line, but a pretty heavy 2 days of selling here. What's your feeling? First of all, how did the inventory numbers come in, and what's your feeling in the bigger picture on what's happening in oil here?
Well, the big picture is definitely interesting. It feels to me like the overall big picture, and we've seen this over a few weeks of inventory now, is the market wants to find a way to move lower. But, you know, you look at what's going on in the news, this Khashoggi thing. And for anyone who hasn't been watching this story, the upshot of it is Khashoggi is a writer for the Washington Post, Saudi Arabian. He walks into the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, supposedly to get a marriage permit because he's engaged. There's a clear video of him walking in. There's no video of him walking out. And the accusation has been that he was murdered because of his critical writing about Saudi Arabia. Prince Mohammed bin Salman absolutely disavowed knowing anything about it, assured President Trump couldn't possibly be, don't know anything about it. And it turns out that they may have actually cut this man up into pieces while he was alive. At least that is the accusation that's being made by Turkey. And their intelligence has apparently bugged the embassy, which is a whole nother twist to the story. When the market opened after this news came out over the weekend, we saw a massive gap up open because everybody was panicking that, you know, maybe Saudi Arabia and the United States get into a major conflict over this thing. That seems to have come out of the market now. And I think what we're seeing is there was a lot of saber rattling on both sides. President Trump, very strong language saying there would be harsh punishment if it turned out to be true. Mohammed bin Salman saying that he wouldn't tolerate that kind of intimidation and would stand up to the United States. I think both leaders needed to be heard so that their constituency would hear them saying what they want to hear. Both of them have kind of backed off afterwards, and it seems like that risk for now is out of the system. We'll see what happens. But in any case, inventory came in. We had API, the private data service that reports on Tuesday afternoon, reporting a surprise drawdown on inventory that moved prices up. We got to $72.50 just from that move, and then we got the real data from EIA, a massive, massive 6.5 million barrel build on inventory on crude. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 827,000 barrels. So we had finished product drawdowns, but massive builds in crude oil inventory, both nationally and in Cushing. That helped to really move prices lower. So I think that all of the signs are that we are in a sustained downtrend. I don't know how far it has to go, but it's got plenty of room if I look at the chart just to get back down to where some of those levels in the $64 or so range were. That seems entirely within reason. On the other hand, this Khashoggi situation, if it really turns out that they butchered this guy while he was alive, bin Salman claimed to have known nothing about it, and now the team of hitmen that did this, supposedly or allegedly, are being linked by the press to being close associates of Mohammed bin Salman. There's potentially a geopolitical upset. You know, there's no limit to how high the price of oil could go if there was a major conflict between the United States and Saudi Arabia. So far, that's not happening. If it starts to happen, we could see a reversal very, very quickly here.
All right, well, let's move on to gold here. Obviously, one of the things we pointed out when gold had that big breakout last week was, can it stick? And, you know, the one thing to me that would have been the most problematic, or at least it would have indicated a false start, is if the sellers just hammered the pop and then they sold it right back down to 1200. But here we are a week later, and bullion is holding up pretty well. And more importantly, it's holding up well while we see that Chinese yuan weakening. So is there a decoupling? I wanted to share a chart with that in the post game, but what's your thinking here on gold? I mean, can we see a breakout here?
Well, I think we should go into more detail in postgame with the benefit of that chart. But briefly, what's most striking to me is look at the upside in the dollar in the last couple of days. And you've got essentially no downside in the gold chart. Now, I don't think it's really no downside. I think it's upside that would have been there, and the upside in the dollar is containing it. But what happens when the dollar is not going straight up anymore? I think it's gold's turn next. And the dollar going straight up did not result this time in gold going straight down, as it has in the past. So if we get to a situation where dollar and gold are both moving up at the same time, that really is a correlation sea change kind of move in the market. And frankly, Patrick, it surprises me, because what I've said for a long time is you just wait. There's going to be a massive move up in gold when we get to crisis mode on the bond market, when we get an actual bond market crisis where there's a crash in the bond market and yields are going through the roof and people are not seeing the safety value in bonds anymore, that's where gold goes through the roof. Until then, I was thinking dollar strength was going to mean gold weakness. it seems like maybe the gold market has sniffed this out sooner than I expected it to, because we're not having that panic sell-off yet in the bond market, and gold is already holding its own. I want to really emphasize the level that Charlie McElligott called, which was 1245 on a closing basis. I realized after Charlie's appearance on the show last week, it may not have been clear where that level came from and why it's so important. Now, where Charlie got that number of 1245, he uses a modeling system where they basically figure out what the large traders, commodity trading advisors that use algorithmic program trading systems to follow trends, where are they going to flip and change their conviction? And 1245 is the number where Charlie gave us. It was something on the order of 40 or 50 billion with a B dollars of buying that would occur. Now, it might sound to some listeners like, yeah, it's just yet another guy who's got yet another model for, you know, modeling markets. Lots of guys have lots of stuff that doesn't always work. The thing is, on the very day that he gave us that, what Patrick and I have the benefit of, because we receive Charlie's institutional letter every day, when we had that Wednesday just massacre in the markets last week, Charlie on that morning before it happened had called every single level that was going to be critical and where those programmatic trading levels would be kicked in and where it would cause the move to accelerate. And he nailed it in every single case. It was exactly right. So that model that worked so well at predicting exactly what would happen if the equity market got to certain levels, Charlie's saying that same exact approach tells him that a daily close over 1245, which we've not seen yet, is really a bullish indication, and then 1299 is another really bullish indication on a closing basis in the gold market. Now, we haven't seen those numbers, but it's no surprise we haven't seen those numbers. We've got really strong dollar right now, and you would expect gold to be going down. Gold's holding its own. As the dollar levels off, if gold makes its way up and closes above 1245, that's a really important bullish signal to watch.
Absolutely. You know, I always say, Eric, that over the long term, fundamentals matter, but over the short term, it's about liquidity. And when you know the levels where there's shifts in liquidity, they often trigger these kind of moves that turn into these opportunities. Nonetheless, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield, because on the Fed minutes, we pop from, you know, 315 to up to 322. It's like, here we go, yields going all over again. But surprisingly, today gave it right back, and we're back down to about 317 or so at the time of recording. And so really, we don't have that strong of a response to the Fed minutes. What's your feeling here about where we're going here with yields?
Well, it's funny how our mindset changes. We're talking about how we're all the way back down, way down to low levels of only 3.17 on the 10-year. You know, just a few weeks ago, that was the level that nobody could believe we'd ever get to. So I think that if you look at what typically happens when you have a major breakout above a critical level, what was a resistance level ends up being retested as support. And I think that 3.11 to 3.15-ish number, which was where the resistance was before, that's now being tested as support. And I think it's very important. It has to hold in order for this signal to be validated. But if it does, I think that it really does signal a major sea change. The thing to keep in mind, though, is we think about something like Julian Brigden's indicator, which is so important. That's the monthly close above 3.25. And I think the number is actually now down to 3.19, which would be a 30-year trend that's broken and reversing. Well, on the one hand, that's an incredibly, incredibly important signal. But on the other hand, the longer term trend that you're talking about, the longer it has to stay above that level in order to really validate it. So just staying above it, even though a couple of weeks seems like a long time, when you're talking about a 30-year trend, we really need to stay above that critical level for, you know, a good couple of months in order to really have strong confirmation that it's not a false breakout and that it's really happening. So far, it seems like these levels are going to hold and that we're headed higher in yield. We'll see what happens. And of course, the big question is, in a lot of ways, it looks like the equity market's in big trouble. Maybe we're headed a lot lower in equities. Maybe this is the sign of an oncoming recession in 2019 or 20. If that's the case, are we going to see what everybody would expect, which is a recession brings much lower yields in bonds, or are we going to have that unexpected outcome where bonds are selling off at the same time as stocks? I think that the latter is very possible, might surprise a lot of people. We'll see what happens.
Well, thanks for the market update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Austrian economist Professor Steve Hanke. Eric's interview with Professor Hanke is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Professor Steve Hanke from Johns Hopkins University. Steve, thanks so much for joining us on the program. We've got you on at a time in markets where the equity market is starting to hiccup. A lot of people are questioning whether or not the central bank liquidity-funded bull market might be coming to an end. I think it would be productive to get your perspective, not just immediately on the current situation, but going back to how we got here. So going back to the last crisis, from your perspective, what were the driving factors? How has it affected monetary policy? And what has actually been driving this massive bull market of the last 10 years?
Well, thank you, Eric, for that introduction. Just to go back to the crisis, shall we say, in 2008 and the start of the Great Recession in 2009, I think it's important to note that the Fed has a propensity to blow bubbles and pop bubbles. So money is important. Money dominates. And if you look at money, it's always wise to look at broad money, the broadest measure of money, which actually is M4. And the best measure of it is what's called Divisia M4. It's produced by the Center for Financial Stability in New York, not the Fed. The Fed has lousy numbers. You look at the Center for Financial Stability. Professor Bill Barnett is the guru on Divisia measures. He knows how to measure the money supply. So it's always important to measure the right thing and look at the right thing. And the right thing is broad money, and the right measure is Divisia M4. And right now, if we jump to today, the Center for Financial Stability has just released its monthly growth rate for Divisia M4, and it's slowed down year over year. It's running only at 4.2%. So that's a fairly slow, moderate to slow number. It's declining. So getting into the current stock market, yeah, they are already taking liquidity out of the system. You don't look at interest rates, you look at broad money, and broad money's going down. The reason you look at broad money is you have to have a model for national income determination, and the best model for national income determination is one in which money dominates. It's a monetarist model. So if you look at the growth rate in broad money, you can anticipate what the nominal growth rate will be in the economy. That's the real growth rate plus inflation. So right now, if we have the Divisia M4 growing at 4.2 and the economy growing at about 4, that implies that there's almost going to be no inflation in the system if real growth continues at a hot pace that it is right now. So that's one aspect. Liquidity is coming out of the U.S. system. But what's overwhelming the market is that the earnings and free cash flow is just dominating the scene. I mean, we have President Trump making all kinds of remarks that are not really very market friendly, should in normal times shake up a market pretty badly. A lot of his protectionist rhetoric and interventionist rhetoric would shake the market, but it hasn't really shaken it too much at all because earnings, free cash flow. So that's the current scene. But going back, Eric, to the start of the crisis, the Fed blows bubbles and then it pops bubbles. We had this happen, and when Greenspan came in January of 1987, he arrived, and what happened? The stock market crashed. So the Fed steps on the accelerator, and we had a bubble. That is a bubble in aggregate demand in the United States. Aggregate demand went way above its trend rate, which is about 4.8%. That's a trend rate in nominal aggregate demand. But it got up to almost 8% in that little bubble. The Fed got worried, inflation started churning up, and so they put on the brakes, and boom, we had actually a mild recession in 1990-1991. Main reason that Clinton won and Bush lost was that recession we got into that was Fed-induced. Things went along, and then we have the Asian financial crisis, 1998. We had the Russian ruble, 1998. We got the Brazilian real goes down in 1998, early 1999. And the Fed steps on it again, and they create a bubble. The bubble was popped, as you recall, in 2001. And we had a big dip in nominal aggregate demand. And then we had Ben Bernanke, who was the governor at the Fed, gave a speech in December of 2003, I believe, going back in the old memory bank, Eric. And that speech emphasized that the big thing that we had to be fighting was deflation. And Bernanke sold Chairman Greenspan on this idea. So they put the Fed funds rate down at that time. It was in July of 2004, and they put it down to 1%, and that resulted in a bubble. And then by the summer of 2008, food prices were going up, commodity prices were going up, and inflation actually hit 5.6% in July of 2008, and the Fed put the brakes on again, and everything slid down. And by September, you've got the Lehman collapse, which we can talk about later, and kind of we're starting the Great Recession then after Lehman. And the important part of Lehman is, number one, the Fed said that they couldn't bail Lehman out and give it a liquidity loan because they were insolvent. Well, they were solvent, or probably solvent, or close to being solvent. This was just a political decision at the time. They'd already bailed out Bear Stearns. Stearns had good collateral, and they loaned them money at a penalty rate. They could have done the same thing for Lehman, but they didn't. They let Lehman go under. And that created a very big panic in the market once Lehman went down and wasn't extended a liquidity loan. At the same time, bankers became the bad guys, and banks became the bad institutions. And we had Dodd-Frank legislation passed, and at about the same time Basel III was coming into the picture, and Basel III requires banks to have more capital. Both of those things put a big squeeze on what I call bank money. The total money supply, this M4 thing that I was talking about, includes two components: state money, that's produced by the Fed, and bank money, that's produced by banks. And at the time Lehman went down, the Fed was operating pretty much normally. They were producing about 10% of the total money supply. 90% was produced by banks. Banks are the elephant in the room. So once the regulation of banks became very severe with Dodd-Frank and the Basel III capital requirements, the bank money supply actually declined. It actually was going down. It wasn't just decelerating. It actually was going down. We had a huge credit crunch upon us. And the decision then was to correct one mistake that the government made, which is this squeeze on the banks. The government decided that they had to do QE, quantitative easing, with the Federal Reserve. If they hadn't done quantitative easing to mitigate the credit squeeze in the banking sector, we would have had a tremendous recession. But many people became all confused by this. They started looking at the Fed. They saw a huge expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. They said, we're going to have hyperinflation, all kinds of terrible things are going to happen, lots of inflation. But they were not realizing that the Fed is peanuts in the money supply game. They were only producing about 10%, even after all of the quantitative easing. Even today, the Fed has only produced, they account for about 16% of the total broad money supply, M4. So banks are the big thing. So at any rate, this tight monetary situation we've been in really since Lehman went down, which is ironically pro-cyclical. We go into a slump, and what's the government do? It introduces a lot of policies that on balance, in aggregate, tighten the money supply, just what you shouldn't be doing. If you're going to run a counter-cyclical policy, you'd want to loosen up when the economy starts slumping. No, we tightened up, and that's the whole name of the game in this very long Great Recession that we've had was excessive bank regulation, excessive tight money, in fact, tight money in total, even though the Fed itself was rather loose in terms of state money. So that's basically where we are, right? Summary of the thing. Many people got off base and got it all wrong. Now, as I say, I still think the overall monetary picture in the United States is on the tightish side. And I say that for two reasons, really. One is the money supply itself is only growing at 4.2% year over year. That's the quantity theory. That's Milton Friedman. That's monetarism. But if you look at supply side economics and people like Bob Mundell, Mundell correctly looks at prices too. And the key prices, the most important price in the world, is the dollar-euro exchange rate. And right now, if you look at that, it's indicating that we're below 120 on the rate. We're below 120. And 120 to 140 is kind of my comfort zone. Being below 120 means that the dollar is very strong against the euro. The second price that's very important to look at is the price of gold. And my comfort zone for gold is about $1,200 per ounce to $1,400 per ounce. And we've been down a little bit below 1,200. Now we're a little bit above 1,200. That indicates that low gold price indicates strong dollar, low commodity prices, low gold prices, low inflation. So it all points towards tightness. As I say, the earnings and free cash flow are so massive, they're just overwhelming this kind of tightness that we have in the monetary sector, and that's the U.S. scene, the U.S. market. If we look at Europe, the European Central Bank is pretty tight, money's pretty tight. And if we look at the big engine for growth in the world economy, of course, is China. China contributes, has been contributing about half of the annual increment to world growth. It comes from China. And China's trend rate of growth in its monetary supply, broad money, M3, has been about 16 or 17% per year for quite some time. Now it's only running about 6.5%. So it's slowed down. Money growth in China slowed way down. And I anticipate they'll have a lot of trouble meeting their target rate of growth of 6.1% in China. And that's very significant, especially for the commodity markets, because China consumes a lot of commodities. It's the tail that wags the dog on many of these markets, China. So that in a nutshell, Eric, it overextended my gracious welcome that you gave me, but that's a kind of the summary picture at 30,000 feet.
You've expressed the view that really what's important is M4 money supply growth, not base money growth, which is what quantitative easing directly enables. And you've said it's not really growing all that fast. So a lot of other people have expressed the view that the what right now has become the longest running bull market in stocks in all of recorded history, a lot of people think it's been fueled by quantitative easing. It sounds like by your logic, maybe you would disagree with that, and perhaps also think that quantitative tightening is premature at this point if we haven't seen enough private banking, broad money growth. Is that accurate, and what do you think the result will be?
I think that's accurate, and I think that the danger that lurks out there is quantitative tightening. The money supply, it's decelerating a little bit now, okay? And it hasn't been over hot, as I indicated. So it's starting to decelerate. And this is a tricky operation, very tricky operation, unwinding this huge balance sheet that the Fed has built up. But remember, we're talking now about only 16% of the money supply is made up by the Fed. So there are things that they can do. Right now, the commercial banks, for example, have massive excess reserves, and they have that because they're getting paid interest on it by the Fed. Okay, so the Fed does actually have a tool that they could unleash commercial banks if they stop paying interest on the excess reserves or reduce the rate at which they pay. So right now, we have to watch very carefully what's going on. But of course, as I try to emphasize, you have to know what you're watching for, what's important. And it's not what everybody's watching. Everybody's watching the Fed funds rate. And interest rates are a very poor guide to monetary policy. They really don't tell us very much. You've got to look at the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and figure out how that is changing, monitor it, diagnose it. And that accounts for, again, a small portion of broad money. But so what do you have to really be analyzing, which most people don't analyze or think about even, and that's commercial banks. Commercial banks produce bank money. Right now, 86% of the total broad money supply is produced by banks. So you have to watch and see what's going on with banks and what policies are affecting banks. Now, one reason, Eric, that people don't watch this very carefully is that policies that affect commercial banks don't change very rapidly, usually. What happened after Lehman? We had Dodd-Frank. That was a massive change. That was the law, not even the regulations. They're still coming up with the regulations. Those are still changing. And bank supervision was changed. And bank capital requirements were changed. We had massive changes affecting banks and affecting the biggest part of the money supply. And people aren't used to monitoring that kind of thing. They don't understand it because it usually doesn't change very much.
So where we stand now is that the Fed is still paying interest on excess reserves, the incentive for the commercial banking system to create more M4 money supply is not really there. With quantitative tightening, there's potentially an incentive as yields get higher for the banks to start buying up some of the treasury securities that the Fed will be selling, and that means that what otherwise could have gone into reserves to capitalize more lending isn't going to happen. So it seems like we've kind of got a setup here with quantitative tightening that could bring this bull market to an end. And I guess, would you agree with that? Do you think that quantitative tightening is the reason that we're seeing right now this big hiccup in equity markets that some people think could be the top of the bull market? And do you think that we're headed into a bear market from here?
I think the biggest risk we face is quantitative tightening right now, that they'll get their feet tangled up, unwinding the Fed balance sheet, and they'll make mistakes. That is the biggest risk. As I say, hard to call a bear market even with mistakes and quantitative tightening because the earnings are so great. So it's very hard to say. I'm not in the sky is falling camp at all. Now, there are, by the way, a lot of bear markets around. I'm talking about New York. There are a lot of bear markets around. Look at the emerging markets right now. And you have a lot of them are in bear market territory. You look at commodities since January, one of the big hot commodities that's gone down on, about 55-60% is lithium. Remember, that was the big deal. And it basically, lithium has shed about half of its value or a little more since the first of the year. But then you look at another commodity, which one has gone up, skyrocketed, is vanadium and gold. I mentioned gold. Lithium and vanadium are two kind of exotic things. I follow the commodities and are involved in these commodity markets. So those are a bit on the exotic side. But just look at gold. What's gold telling us? Gold is telling us that the dollar is obviously very strong, and that inflation isn't in the near-term horizon. Things are slowing down. Things are on the slowish side. So that's the quantitative tightening kind of risk. If you look at the money supply growth, it's slowing. If you look at the dollar-euro rate, the dollar is very high, suggesting tightness. If you look at the gold market, the price is sluggish. suggesting tightness on the part of the U.S., but not necessarily other markets might even be in worse shape, and they are, the emerging markets.
You've written quite a bit on foreign exchange markets, and specifically, you have suggested that stabilizing the dollar-euro exchange rate would go a long way to help financial markets generally. What's the rationale there? What's the logic? Tell us the story.
Well, the story is one of stability. If, as according to Bob Mundell, the dollar-euro rate's the most important price in the world, which it is, I agree with Bob on that, then if it's the anchor for everything and the nexus for everything going on in the international markets, it's better to have it stabilized than volatile. So, and to do that, you would have to basically stabilize the monetary policy in the United States and Europe to have it coordinated. So what would happen if you had a range of 120 to 140 at the rate, when the dollar got weak, as it was, by the way, it was very weak before the Lehman collapse. It was all over 155. So the dollar was very weak against the euro right before all hell broke loose. And we had commodity prices were going up. All the congressional testimony in the summer of 2008 was about commodity prices. Food prices were going through the roof. Inflation in the United States, the CPI, was 5.6% on an annual basis in July of 2008. So at that rate, at 155, you're way outside the 140 range. And what would happen? You would have an agreement between, it would be the U.S. Treasury, because the Treasury is the one responsible for the dollar, not the Fed, between the U.S. Treasury and the European Central Bank. In that case, with the weak dollar, the European Central Bank would buy dollars. They would intervene to buy the dollar. And by doing that, obviously, they're going to strengthen the dollar because of the intervention. But what are they going to buy the dollars with? By emitting more euros. So in that case, you would have a relative loosening of monetary policy in Europe. The euro would get a little bit weaker, the dollar would get a little bit stronger because of the direct intervention, and you'd get back in the zone. And if the dollar was very strong, like it is right now, what you would have is a situation where the dollar was strong, the euro was weak, and the Fed would buy the euro and strengthen the euro relative to the dollar, and that would happen because by buying the euro, the Fed would buy it with what? They'd have to emit more dollars. They'd have to expand the money supply. So the Fed would become a little looser. So right now, today, if you had this kind of rule, the Fed would be intervening. They'd be buying weak euros. They'd be emitting more dollars, loosening up the Fed's monetary policy relative to the European Central Bank, and you'd get back in the above 120. Now we're below 120. So the idea is stability. You'd have a corridor of 120 to 140, and since everything is international financial markets is basically geared off of this exchange rate, or everything might be an exaggeration, but a lot of things are geared off of it. That's why Mundell can say it's the most important price in the world. You'd have stability. You wouldn't have a lot of volatility going on. You wouldn't even have as much volatility in the emerging markets, you see, because this stability with the dollar-euro rate would tend to reduce the carry trade kind of thing. Now, by the way, the carry trade, that was one real problem with the quantitative easing. The quantitative easing, you put U.S. interest rates down to almost nothing, and everyone's looking for yield, so they're chasing yield. They're chasing yield all over the world. They're taking all kinds of risks that normally they wouldn't be taking. And they're leveraging up. They're getting a little more yield. They're chasing it, trying to find it, and they're leveraging up. So they're taking a lot more risk, and they're much more vulnerable, the investors, than if you'd have stability and you hadn't had quantitative easing and you wouldn't have had the need for quantitative easing, meaning you would have bailed out a solvent Lehman Brothers, number one. So that's point number one. if you would have done this, you wouldn't have had all these excruciatingly painful bank regulations coming in with Dodd-Frank that created a massive pro-cyclical policy that, in fact, had to be offset by quantitative easing, or we would have been really in the tank. But the quantitative easing came with lots of costs. It mitigated the business cycle problems associated with bank regulation, but it created many price signal distortions. And the biggest one and the easiest one to think about is chasing yield and leveraging up and taking way too much risk. And that's what we're paying the price for now. I mean, you got the Argentine peso, you got the Turkish lira, you got the Indonesian rupiah, you got the Indian rupee at the all-time lows. All of these currencies and markets have been disrupted, bubbles popping, because ultimately there was quantitative easing, and the quantitative easing due to yield chasing got people in these markets in the first place.
As you mentioned the Argentine peso, that brings another topic to mind that I know you're an expert on, the topic of hyperinflation. And I'd really like to touch on this one because, frankly, I find a lot of people in finance use this term very loosely. I think a lot of them don't understand its actual definition, because I have people all the time telling me, you know, oh, we're going to have hyperinflation like the hyperinflation we had in the United States in the 1970s. And it just makes me think, boy, they're reading a different textbook than I am. So why don't we start with just a definition? What exactly does the phrase hyperinflation mean?
Technically, the convention in the economics profession, the scientific community, is that hyperinflation is reached after the monthly inflation rate exceeds 50% per month for 30 consecutive days. So if we look at that right now, today, the only country that's hyperinflating is Venezuela. Today's inflation rate, I measure this every day with high-frequency data, it's 50,574% today as we speak, and the monthly rate of inflation is 63%. And how I get that is I look at the change in the black market exchange rate, the free market exchange rate, and apply purchasing power parity theory to the change in the exchange rate, and that can be transformed into an implied inflation rate for the overall economy, counting accounts. Everything is in the basket. I mean, it's all goods, all services, all assets are included. So that's where we're at with Venezuela. There have been 58 hyperinflations in world history. The largest one was in Hungary in 1946, July of 1946. Prices were doubling every 15 hours. The second highest one was rather recently, actually, in Zimbabwe. It was in November 2008. And then the daily rate of inflation was 98%. So the prices were doubling every 24.7 hours. One that I personally measured, I measured, by the way, like I'm the only one who's actually, I know I'm the only one who actually accurately measured the Zimbabwe hyperinflation in 2008. Another one I measured accurately was Yugoslavia in January of 1994. Then the monthly inflation rate, Eric, was 313 million%. So these are very high rates of inflation, hard to get your head around kind of numbers. The one in Venezuela now is kind of modest. It's puts Venezuela in it, the 23rd rank out of the 58 hyperinflations that have been recorded in world history. And that, if you want to see that, Nick Cruz and I wrote the chapter in the Routledge Handbook of Major Events in Economic History, and we wrote the chapter on hyperinflation. So you can find all these cases and details and so forth. The one thing it might be modest, the Venezuelan inflation, but it's lasted quite a while, actually. It's lasted almost 2 years, and there are only 8 hyperinflations that have lasted longer than Venezuela. So its rate of inflation is, by hyperinflation standards, modest, but its longevity, it's quite long. Most hyperinflations, almost all of them, have lasted less than a year, and many of them have lasted, let's see, 22 out of the 58 have lasted less than 2 months.
With that definition in place of hyperinflation as a rate of consumer price increase of more than 50% per month, needless to say, that makes a lot of large inflations, like even the 2000 Argentine inflation, not qualify. That was about 80% per year. Obviously, this is a different phenomenon than just high inflation like we had in the United States in the 1970s. So when we have a hyperinflation, what is going on? What conceptually is the driving force that causes those just extraordinarily high rates of price inflation?
They all start, you have to go back to Milton Friedman. Now, Milton Friedman always had a line that the cause of inflation is always and everywhere, it's a monetary phenomenon. What Milton said is correct. But the question is that you're getting at, Eric, is, yeah, but what starts the money supply from going up so fast? They're always the source is a fiscal problem. The government spends money, but for one reason or another, they don't have any sources to finance it except the central bank. And if you think about Venezuela, to make it concrete, the government, it's a socialist government, it's spending a lot of money. And what are the sources of revenue? Well, one source of revenue is PDVSA, the state-owned oil company. But the state-owned oil company is running negative cash flow, so that's not a source of income. That's a drain, actually. The second thing is the bond market. You can issue bonds to finance the government, but the international bond market in Venezuela is cut off. They can't put out any international bonds. And the domestic bond market is totally plugged up because the banks are up to their eyeballs in domestic debt denominated in bolivars. Taxes, you run into a problem. It's something called a Tanzi effect when you have a hyperinflation, because the taxes are assessed. Let's say you have a tax and it's assessed on January 1 and you're required to pay it in April or July or some later date. Well, by the time you get around to paying it, the real value of the thing has withered away to almost nothing. So the government basically gets nothing because they have to wait for you to pay. But in the meantime, the payments have been inflated away. So what's the government do? The government goes to the central bank and they order the central bank to buy bonds issued by the state. And the bank turns on the proverbial printing press. And that's how you get hyperinflation. In Yugoslavia, just to give you, Eric, a sense of what was going on, in 1994, when the hyperinflation peaked out at 313 million% a month, about 97% of all government expenditures in Yugoslavia were being financed by the central bank. So to stop a hyperinflation, you've got to get rid of the central bank. It's easy to do. If you dollarize the economy and get rid of the central bank, or as we did in Montenegro in 1999, we threw out the Yugoslav dinar and replaced it with a Deutsche Mark, and inflation, of course, stopped immediately. And you have, once you get rid of the central bank, you have a hard budget constraint in the system. The hard budget constraint is that the government can't go to the central bank and borrow money. So that's the easiest way to solve the hyperinflations. What goes on in the street, by the way, is not official dollarization, but spontaneous dollarization. People substitute some foreign currency for the lousy money that's being emitted by the central bank. So in Venezuela, if somebody gets a bolivar, they have two things they can do. They can either buy some commodity immediately with it before it withers away in their hand, or they can go to the black market and buy U.S. dollars. But they get rid of the local currency as fast as they can. So the velocity of the turnover of the money is fantastic in a hyperinflation. You just, anyone that keeps a bolivar for more than 24 hours is just a fool. I mean, no one would do that. So you buy a commodity, you buy a dollar. That's what's going on.
Now, it's thankfully settled down a bit in the last couple of years, but for a while we had all kinds of fringe bloggers and other people getting everybody worried about how the U.S. dollar was going to experience hyperinflation. And I think the logic went something like, you know, look at Weimar Germany. There have been other places around the world where governments spent beyond their means. Certainly the U.S. government has spent beyond its means. It's been forced to resort to quantitative easing, which by any reasonable evaluation is an extreme measure. So surely we're about to have a U.S. dollar hyperinflation. Please explain for our listeners why there are some holes in that line of logic, to say the very least.
Well, the biggest hole in it is that the dollar is the world currency. Most people don't realize this. If you go back 2,500 years, there always has been one dominant international currency, always. And the average life of those dominant currencies is about 300 years. Now, and what knocks them off the top of the mountain is usually some monetary mistake. The issue or the sovereign makes some mistake, or the sovereign is knocked out in a war. So either some monetary policy mistake that it's almost always associated with a war, by the way. Remember, World War I, sterling was on top of the mountain. And World War I came along, the Brits had to borrow a lot of money, and they got into some silly monetary policies. Sterling took a pounding, and the opportunity arose for what? The dollar to enter and as a challenger. And eventually it took out sterling as the number one currency. So today, people don't realize the dollar is just completely dominant in all international activities. We know oil is priced in dollars. We know all agricultural commodities are priced in dollars. All basic materials are priced in dollars. Most people don't realize that a lot of manufacturers that are exported from, for example, Japan, about 65% of all the exports from Japan are actually priced and invoiced in dollars, not yen. So the dollar, international reserves at central banks, you name it, the dollar just completely dominates. Now, this right now, of course, eventually the dollar could be challenged. I think if these international sanctions and international tariff games continue, those are the kinds of stupidities that can ultimately make a currency vulnerable. And the way they're throwing these international sanctions around, these international financial sanctions, they have a huge unit at the U.S. Treasury who dreams up these things that they impose from almost every day on somebody new. This is a potential threat to the dollar's dominance. But right now, the dollar is dominant. And that gives us, by the way, and the reason this can go on and on and on and on, and the reason we have run a large trade deficit since 1975 with no problems, by the way. It's not a problem. Trump's worried about it, but it's not a problem. The reason why we have an exorbitant privilege, we are issuing the world's currency, the dominant currency, and that means that the borrowing cost in dollars is very low. So we can borrow and finance our trade deficits at very low cost and to the advantage of the United States consumer. So the picture is the sky is falling. You have a lot of really honestly monetary cranks running around saying that, you know, things are going to go bad and go south immediately, and they'll go very bad. The Chicken Little problem, it's not going to happen. I mean, it's not something you worry about or should be worried about. This is just not going to happen, period, in the foreseeable future. That isn't to say that the dollar might become more vulnerable over time, and I think the big vulnerability will be protectionism and these military sanctions. These are acts of war, these financial sanctions that are put on people and countries. I'm completely against these, as well as trade restrictions of all kind, because they're interfering with free and voluntary exchanges between sellers and buyers.
Well, and certainly Russia and others have been cautioning that U.S. policy is threatening the reserve currency status of the dollar. So it'll be interesting to see what the next several years bring. We're unfortunately out of time. Steve, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before we let you go, where can our listeners who'd like to follow your work find out more about you?
Well, there are two places. If you go to the Cato Institute website, you will find, go to Hanke, H-A-N-K-E, you'll find my little sub website there. And there's also another sub website on the Cato site, the Trouble Currency Project, which I direct. You find that there. So that's one place. The other place is at Johns Hopkins University Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprise. I direct that, and we have a big website with many working papers, many of my papers. Some of my books are actually in a PDF form on that Johns Hopkins website. So either the Cato Institute or Johns Hopkins University will get me.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Professor Hanke. I'm an Austrian economist at heart. I love the idea of studying of money supply as an indicator for understanding, you know, credit flows and how it all works. So it's great to hear some perspectives on that side there. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, two things stood out for me. One is it's so refreshing to have someone talk about hyperinflation who knows the definition of the term. It blows my mind how many people in finance, professionals who are supposed to know better, will say, oh, we're going to have hyperinflation like we had in the 1970s. And it's like, that's not hyperinflation. Professor Hanke has exactly the right definition. It's 50% per month. That annualizes to something upwards of 1,000% annually. Even the Argentine inflation around 2000 didn't qualify as a hyperinflation by the correct definition. And the mechanics of what causes high sustained levels of inflation, like you had in the United States in the 1970s, versus what causes an outright collapse of a currency system and a hyperinflation, are completely different. So it's so refreshing to have somebody who uses the terminology correctly to talk to about it. But the other thing, Patrick, that I thought was very interesting is we've got two professors of economics. Both of them are non-mainstream guys. Professor Steve Keen is a post-Keynesian, and Professor Hanke, of course, is an Austrian economist. And they have opposite views on whether or not the U.S. dollar's reserve currency status is a positive or a negative thing for the United States. Now, I actually agree with Professor Hanke that the U.S. gets a tremendous amount of benefit from all the artificial demand that exists for dollars because it allows the U.S. government to borrow and spend beyond its means. And as much as politicians would like to think that deficits don't matter, the real statement is deficits always matter, but you get away with it almost indefinitely. You can postpone the adverse consequence of deficit spending when you are the reserve currency issuer. And when you lose that status, it changes, and it changes fast. So I think a huge risk to the U.S. economy is the potential loss of reserve currency status, as we discussed in this interview. Professor Steve Keen is no schmuck. He's a really smart guy. He sees it the opposite way. And I'd love to have more conversation with Steve Keen about that because I just don't understand. I certainly understand his argument, which is that there is a downside to having all that extra dollar strength in terms of U.S. export businesses. But compared to the importance of the benefits the U.S. government derives, it's fascinating to me that we see such brilliant economists with such opposing views on something so important. I'd love to talk more to Steve Keen about that one. Meanwhile, though, Patrick, I want to talk more to you about this week's postgame chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. You're not going to want to miss this one because Patrick's put some really great charts together. Let's dive right into chart number two. We're looking at something else Professor Hanke emphasized, which is Euro-USD. What's going on here? What are the two red lines and particularly the volume on the left side? Tell us the significance of those high volume nodes.
All right. Well, first of all, Professor Hanke was talking about the importance of the euro staying within the 120 to 140 zone and really the emphasis of the problems that are being caused through tightening that are driving the euro down below these levels. But, you know, what's interesting is that while the 120 level is important in his mind, on a technical basis, a true and meaningful consolidation has been really developing between the sort of 116 to 118 level. So the volume by price bars on the left-hand side are showing where the vast majority of volume traded by price. And what was particularly interesting about this is that we are now seeing legitimate price action now breaking down toward 115 and now below 115 on the euro. This is a deterioration that may lead to another leg of a trend. Now, I don't want to already say that the break has happened. We certainly are in this kind of low volume zone where this can truly accelerate. But if we break legitimately below 115 and hold it, to me, we're talking downside risk from a technical perspective down to 110 or lower on that euro. And that's what would drive with a 57-58% weighting into that dollar index. If we ever wanted to see what was going to drive that move above 96 and head to 97-98 on the Dixie, that would be this break in the euro. And so I just thought it was worth technically talking about.
And moving on to slide number three, we're moving on to gold bullion, which is obviously very important. What do you see in the chart? What are you telling your big picture trading members about this one?
Well, first of all, we put this chart up last week. So this is just a continuation. We have five little candles added to the gold chart with that line that marked the breakout. But I just really first wanted to point out was that there seems to be a little bit of a decoupling here between the yuan and gold bullion. So we had the currency weakened considerably, and it was almost non-responsive on gold. I always say something like a few days like this is not enough to define a new trend, but it is a worthwhile thing for us to observe on the show, whether this is market noise or whether this is actually a meaningful decoupling and whether gold can really kind of march to the beat of its own drum. Looking at that kind of volume bars again on the left-hand side, you can see heavy gold consolidation again in this kind of 1180 to, well, surprise, surprise, around this kind of 1240, 1245. And really that air pocket of low volume, it really starts above 1245. So you can really see where there's some technical validation to a break of that level. It could really accelerate a liquidity event above there. Will we get it? That's time will tell, but it's certainly a worthwhile thing to watch. But really it's on chart four that I thought it was worthwhile. I want to give a shout out to Kevin Muir, the macro tourist there, because we were kind of messing around with these charts, and he pointed out this chart of looking at gold as it's priced in yuan terms. There was a substantial floor to the 8200 level. Basically, the whole idea was that China was in some way or another defending that price level of their currency against gold, or vice versa. And what's interesting, that what Kevin shared his idea was he didn't think it was a peg as much as a floor. And his idea was that, well, the floor was being defended, but the upside potential is not. And so if this really is a legitimate breakout, that it really can go. And so it's also an interesting observation to watch and see whether this kind of break to 8,500 of the gold CNY actually sticks and actually follows through.
Well, it's something that always makes me curious when I see a descending triangle chart like this. You know, oftentimes breakouts on these charts, you will see it roll back over and come down and retest that descending line just below where the actual breakout occurred, and then it takes off to the upside. Do you think that's in the cards in this chart based on what you see here? And if so, what would it mean for the gold price?
I mean, that's a lot of moving parts because you're forecasting currencies movement at the same time as forecasting the gold price. It could happen, but really, to me, I think it's more the actual physical price of gold, again, in U.S. dollar terms. You know, to me, holding bullion holding above, you know, 1215, 1220 would be very encouraging, because to me, if gold was to break back down below 1210 and head back to 1200, it would basically be sort of all the air being taken out of the sales. Like the chance that gold was going to break really needs to see bullish follow through. And so really, I think it's more watching gold in US dollar terms that's going to be most interesting.
Patrick, on page 5, you've got Ray Dalio looking depressed because he's yet to appear on Macro Voices. I'm sure that's the reason for the look on his face. But what about the quote on the left-hand side?
Well, really what I was just wanted to do is point out a quote that we referenced a couple of weeks back when we were talking about his debt crisis book. And one of the lines out of the book, which resonated with me, was where he's making the point that the fastest rate of tightening typically comes about 5 months prior to the top of a stock market. He's making the point that, look, it's the Fed usually tightens, and policy error is almost a standard thing where they raise interest rates so high that they ultimately turn the economy into a recession. And it's that point where they have the fastest rate of tightening that marks the countdown for that. And so on page 6, what I did was I put the Fed funds rate, and I wanted to just point out, so 2017 and 2018 basically had two very similar rate hike cycles. So we saw interest rates go from about, you know, give or take 40 basis points at the start of 2017 to just being about 1.15, which was more or less about a 75 basis point rise. Subsequently, 2018 has a year to date seen a rise from about 1.15 to 1.95, about 80 basis points, a little bit faster in a shorter period of time. But what's interesting about this, so we had about 80 basis points tacked on so far calendar year. But when we go to chart 7, where we take the spread between euro dollar futures, obviously this is more LIBOR rates, but we take the spread between the December 2018 and December 2019 contracts, we went at the start of 2018 with them pricing in pretty much less than one rate hike in 2019. And up until September, they were pricing in about 34 basis points, just over one rate hike next year. And obviously, when the hawkish Fed news came out at the start of September and the market responded here in the last month, we saw that jump to almost 60 basis points, now hovering around about 56 basis points. So we're pricing in two full rate hikes next year. But the question is that trend continue? Is the market going to start pricing in the 3 to 4 rate hikes to keep the rate of interest rate hikes the same as it was last year? Or are we witnessing that this year in 2018 was going to mark the fastest rate of rate hikes? And if that's the case, are we already counting down the stock market peak?
Now, Patrick, in the market wrap at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that Charlie McElligott's work points to a number of key levels in markets where if it moves past a certain level, it's likely to keep going because it forces a change in what algorithmic traders are doing. And there's also another concept, which is a lot of hedgers, a lot of people who are, say, option market makers who want to stay delta neutral all the time, they systematically have to buy and sell futures in reaction to certain market events. And it's not a matter of somebody making a speculative decision that they're going to bet on the stock market. It's mechanical things that hedgers have to do in order to balance their books. How do those factors come into play here, and what will we expect in terms of levels that might cause the market movement to accelerate in one direction or the other?
All right. Well, Eric, on pages 8 and 9, what I really wanted to do was elaborate on Charlie's interview, because Charlie is so smart. He came on, gave us some amazing numbers. Just love his work. But, you know, a lot of our listeners gave us feedback. It's like, that's going over my head. I don't understand what all of this means. And so I wanted to share a couple of charts to kind of explain where the gamma risks are and all of these elements that are influencing the volatility we're experiencing in the markets today. today. One of the things that Charlie was talking about was the massive, almost golf ball and a garden hose amount of open interest that is open at the 2800 and 2750 lines on the S&P 500. And what it means is that when there's a very large amount of open interest there, it means that if the dealers have that on their books, they themselves have to be hedging their risk if the goal is to stay delta neutral, which is basically the dealers dealing, but they don't want that market exposure on their books. And so what Gamma is measuring is how fast the dealers are getting offside on their deltas. If delta was constant, then it would be easy to calculate. They would short a certain amount and then they would be fine. But because delta is increasing or decreasing, it's doing so at the rate of gamma. And so gamma is telling you how much the dealers are going to be offside for every, let's say, 1% move in the market. And so what is what's showing here on chart 8 is the massive open interest at those two strike prices. But what's interesting is you can identify in the blue bars that pretty much 40% of the gamma exposure lies on the October 19th expiration, which is literally 24 hours from the time when we're recording. And which means that literally this weekend, we're going to have a huge gamma roll-off. And I can assure you that those dealers are, the weekend can't come fast enough for them, right? Hoping that the market stays pinned in here without them having to go into the market to do that. But really, the best way to illustrate this is on page 9, where it's a Morgan Stanley piece from QDS. And they basically are talking about how the estimated dealer gamma is going by the spot price. And they're showing you the levels from which dealers are going to have to buy back shorts and or go long exposure, which you can see at this level crosses the zero line above around the 2830 level on the S&P 500, and then really accelerates from there. And so it's, in my mind, it's a really getting above that 2830 level where a lot of this negative liquidity problems that are coming, at least from the option dealers, can actually turn into a positive. But at the same time, the key levels where the gamma exposure accelerates to the downside is below, guess what, the 2750, but even more so below the kind of 2720 area, two levels that Charlie talked about when we had him on the show. And so on that chart that I showed on 10 is I showed the levels on the S&P chart. And the two middle lines, the blue and the red, is sort of the two strike prices of 2750 and 2800, where generally the more we're getting below at or below these lines, the more risk there is that there's going to be a big gamma influence on the dealers, which are going to be forced to sell. I think the number Charlie was sharing with us at the time when of the interview was something like $20-25 billion for every 1% move in the S&P. That's new futures to sell by dealers to stay delta neutral. And so in my mind, this is a critical thing, especially going into this weekend. If we can kind of get into the middle of next week and a lot of this gamma rolls off, then that will become a less of a liquidity influence on the S&P 500 movement. But, you know, if in the next day or two going into the weekend, if we break below 2750, it could create a feedback loop of selling, especially if we get 2720, where CTA selling kicks in with another $50 billion to sell. We could have a pretty serious next liquidity event if those levels are broken. And that's a big if, because I in no way want our listeners to think that I know it's going to happen. But these are the risk levels, and I just thought it was worthy of pointing it out. And that green line on that line is the 2830 level, where we're above there. Suddenly that becomes what was a headwind for the market becomes a tailwind in terms of the gamma.
Okay, so in terms of this gamma roll-off risk, we're really talking about the rest of this week, which is one more day by the time people will hear this broadcast. And if we go below these first red line, and especially if we go below the second red line, look out, Houston, we have a problem. If we manage to get above the green, then that's a really bullish sign in terms of where we could be headed from there. Is that basically the summary?
You know, bullish or bearish, it's more about what will drive liquidity on the very short term. Obviously, by the middle of next week or by even the week after that, the entire picture may be completely different, right? And so these are the most relevant levels that will drive drive short-term liquidity flows that will be kind of marking where the short-term swing is going to go in the market. My intuition, even though you were suggesting that you think that the tops are in for the year, I'm not opposed to the idea that we have after this sell-off, even if there is one more little leg down here coming, that we still have sort of a year-end kind of push. To me, the really big tell later this year is whether or not the S&P can make higher highs, because the global equity markets are a complete mess. And the only thing that's been positive has been the U.S. equity markets. And if we see that the bulls and the buy on dip traders cannot break the markets back to new highs, and then this becomes very toppy, and then a lot more bearish things can start to emerge in 2019.
Patrick, as we get into all of this depth on options concepts, we've already gotten several emails from people who missed your free webinar. So if you missed last Sunday's webinar, just go to bigpicturetrading.com. The recording is there on the slider on the main page at bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, meanwhile, we got more emails complaining, and I suppose we're guilty as charged. We've talked quite a bit that you are speaking next weekend in San Francisco at the Silver and Gold Summit. We have yet to point out or explain to our listeners, our oversight on our part, what the heck it is that you're going to be speaking about. So please fill us in.
Well, really, I wanted to kind of build on that presentation I did at Macro Voices Live, where we were talking about the commodity cycles. And so anyone who wants to watch that presentation can just make a donation on our website at macrovoices.com, and you can watch the video. But really, I want to put a focus on that commodity cycles directly onto gold and silver. But not only am I going to be talking about the idea of using long-dated options for trading those cycles, but now I'm going to also touch on options as an income strategy for gold and silver, as well as the idea of how to hedge, including using collars on your bullion. And so I'm going to do a number of little fun option strategies that I'm going to talk about.
And again, that is next weekend in San Francisco. And folks, you've got a link in your Research Roundup email for registration. Be sure to use the discount code MACRO to get a 30% off discount on your registration for the Silver and Gold Summit. Meanwhile, we need to leave it there for this week. Folks, we need your help. Please help us to promote Macro Voices by telling your friends and colleagues, forward your Research Roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a few minutes, and the benefit to you is that you'll receive our free Research Roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It is just a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
You'll find the transcript for today's interview with Professor Hanke. You'll also find the link to his charts and articles that accompanied the interview, as well, obviously, the chart book we discussed in the post game, with looking at all the dealer gamma and all of the different charts on gold as well. There's also an article from Kevin Muir on when will chasing the hot stocks no longer work. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library.
And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.